It's a crazy chicken plucker named Darren, with no tattoos, freckles, only Darren staring down the microphone. Darren Carter will tickle your funny bone with a ho 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 and a ha ha laugh. Tune in and listen on the Bucket Party Podcast.
Oh yeah, baby, you know what time it is. Time to get that party started all up in your ear holes. Here we go. When you had a bad day and you want those bad vibes to go away,
when every day life gets harder, Darren
Carter,
you need the party starter.
It's the Pocket Party Podcast
with Darren.
Pocket Party Podcast
in your ear holes.
Pocket Party Podcast,
it's in your ear holes.
Pocket Party Podcast. Oh, if your day needed a booster, then you need to talk to Red Rooster. Mr. Carter about to take you to school. Here we go. Don't hurt nobody. Don't hurt yourself.
Is that a party in your pocket?
And we're back. Yes. Thank you. As I make my own applause. From the new Zoom PodTrack P4, paid for you, brought to you by the people that donated. Once again, I'm doing the intro at 2:30 in the morning on like 6 hours of sleep because I banged out more videos, put them up on my YouTube channel. But I want to do a shout out right now to Mark Brewer. Mark Brewer, thank you for the donation. Appreciate it, buddy. Thank you so much. Hit me up on that Venmo at Darren Carter Comic. Yeah, all he wanted was a shout out. Like I said, throw a little something on the Venmo and I can read an ad for you. I can plug your social media and I'm basically here for you, man. So I appreciate you guys. And I want to thank all the regular people that donate on a regular basis. Thank you so much. Like I said, the reason that this sounds so crisp and clear and we have sound effects like and more, because of you. So thank you. Listen, we're going to get into this podcast and I want to thank you guys for checking in. I know I'm in your rotation and I appreciate it. There's so many positive people out there giving me messages. Hit me up on the DM, hit me up on YouTube, leaving comments, all the people from around the world. It's really interesting. Sometimes I'll ask, hey, where are you? And how did you find out about the podcast and what are your listening habits? I end up bugging people, I think, because they'll start out with like a casual compliment and I'm like, well, thank you so much. And I'm like, because I'm just curious. I'm like, well, how did you find out about it or what up, you know, whatever. I like to ask questions and it's like, it helps me out. But anyways, I thank you guys so much. And I'm telling you, once I get settled in, and it's going to happen now that I have this machine, I'll be able to crank out more podcasts. And I think what I'm going to do, I can record phone calls so I can call my friends. And my funny friends, you know, I have all these great comedian friends of mine, and they're great storytellers. And some of them, you know, they're not technological advanced. Like, meaning they don't know how to do a Zoom call, which your average kindergartner can do now. But, you know, some of these guys, but if I can call them, it'll be pretty cool. You know what? I even have this sound effect, and I didn't load it into the machine. Let's see if it does it when I'm, I don't think it's going to play. Or maybe it will. This will be really bad if it does. Okay, whatever. You know what? I ain't going to do it. Okay, no problem. All it was me saying, boring, which, you know, I just said it. Why would I need a sound bite to say boring when I can just do it myself? But guys, listen, we're going to get into the podcast. Mike Black is a great storyteller. We have a lot of fun. And I want to thank you guys for checking out the Pocket Party Podcast. Do me a favor, please share the link. Let people know. It lets me know you care. All right, now let's start that party in your ear holes.
And we're back, Mr. Mike Black Attack. Where are you coming from us today, buddy? You're always in a different location.
Today I'm coming from the parking lot of a, I won't say their name, but a chicken place in scenic Culver City.
Did they used to be finger licking?
I'm sure they did some finger licking at some point. That sounds dirty, but they, yeah. I'm sure they've been known to lick some fingers here and there.
I think KFC changed their model, right? They're no longer finger licking good. Like, they don't want to be involved with finger licking anymore.
Well, because of COVID-19, they can't really be. No one yeah. should be. The Colonel yeah. doesn't want anyone licking anyone's fingers.
Yeah.
Right now.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly. You know, a year from now, we're back to finger licking.
Yeah. Yeah. Like, best case scenario, one of these days we're going to get back to finger licking.
Yeah. You
know, the new normal, though, is no finger licking right now.
Yeah. That's
to prevent the spread of COVID.
Yeah.
Do not lick each other's fingers. That was as close to sex as they got in the 50s to premarital sex was. Yeah, everyone would go have they'd go to the Colonel's house, because back then it wasn't a restaurant, it was the Colonel's big mansion, and they would all have chicken and then lick each other's fingers, and they were like, I did it, that's I'm not a virgin anymore.
Yeah, between some Kentucky Fried Chicken and the game of Twister, it was was on.
Back then, a heart attack and an orgasm were very, very close. It was a razor's edge between those two things.
Did you ever
half
get into
kids you died of in, cholesterol poisoning?
Yeah, yeah. did you ever get into Twister? You ever play it?
Did I ever get into Twister? Like,
yeah.
Well, it depends on what you mean.
Yeah, you really don't. That's something someone gets into. Oh, it's my thing, man. Twister.
It could be. I wish I was that kind of kid that had like a smoking jacket and a long cigarette holder and invited girls over to play Twister. I was not. I didn't have that kind of game. Where I was like, let me make us some martinis and then we'll all play Twister. You know?
Everybody get down to your socks.
Yeah. I wish I'd been that cool. I was nothing like that.
Right foot green circle.
Instead
left
of Twister.
Left hand yellow circle. Yeah.
Instead of Twister, I once let a girl bore me to tears playing Magic the Gathering. That's as close to that kind of game as I got.
You know, I guess every generation is into their boringness, but like you're a little bit younger than me, and I think Magic the Gathering became popular when I was already in my 20s, so I kind of dodged that.
Oh, bullet. Well, this date was in my 20s. This was a horrible date in my 20s. And she had numerous magical decks of cards.
Oh, wow.
And I had never played the game before. And she was like, I'm going to give you a starter deck. And then all I have is the other 950 decks that I've assembled over the course of playing this game. And my deck, the magic that I had was plant-based. Yeah. So it was all like, my army of broccoli is attacking your wizard right now. And she's like, that's cool. All of my goblins have rocket launchers. And I'm like, well, there goes.
Yeah.
But she wouldn't kill me. She kept like resurrecting my guy. Like he'd die. And then she'd roll again and be like, oh, I resurrected your character so you can live a little longer. Yeah. And I was like, great. Why don't I just pay for our coffee and go away? Because this is the worst date I've ever been on in my life.
I feel like this is like a whole scene. You know, like for a while I was really getting into like buying chess boards, and so I was looking up different like game shops around LA, and there's places that were like half game rooms or game selling board games, and then in the back was like places where people would do like these Magic the Gatherings and D&D or whatever. Did you ever get into that scene where you
dudes and whatnot?
There'd be like
the painted guys. My buddy DeWitt on the Power Pals podcast, he has another podcast. We're now three podcasts away from this one called Legends of the Painty Men. And it's all about playing those kind of games. And I guess they have a massive following because they're the only ones doing a podcast about that stuff.
Nice.
But so I don't. Yeah.
That's like a whole scene.
The one time that I was tempted to get into it recently was a lot of like artists will make little characters on their own without necessarily getting the rights to them.
Yeah.
And so some guy on his own made the Time Bandits. You remember that movie?
Yeah, I remember it. I didn't
all
didn't
the Monty Python. It's a great movie if you haven't seen it. But he made all of the Time Bandits, but he called them something else, like Chronology Burglars or something like that. You know, something just off enough from Time Bandits. And I was like, man, if I was ever going to pull the trigger on this sort of thing, this would have been the time. but I didn't. I can't get into rolling the dice. Basically, all of those games, like Dungeons and Dragons and all the tabletop role-playing sort of games, I don't have a problem with them. I get why people like them. To me, they're all a very elaborate trick to get kids to do math.
Oh, yeah. Because
that's pretty much all it is rolling dice, and then everyone does a bunch of math, and then they go, okay, well, your warrior died. After all that math, my warrior's dead.
Yeah.
Screw this game. I don't want to play this ever again.
Yeah. See,
what I like about video game versions of that is, in a video game, the high-tech computer software that you have will do all the math for you, and then just show you the cool, like, you're a barbarian killing a dragon or whatever. You know?
Yeah.
That's what I want, you know.
You're like, let me just cut to the chase, man. Like, have the fun.
Yeah, I want the exciting part. I don't want the, like, oh, well, if your armor class is 11 and you fire that arrow at, you know, if you roll 30, that arrow will hit some. Oh, why? Why are we doing this? Yeah. This is like being audited.
Yes. You know, I was thinking about this, and I wanted to get to that. We got some things we got to get to. I wanted to know how you got into stand-up comedy. You know, I was thinking about that. I was out there on my bike out there at the farm, and I'm riding. I'm like, I wonder how Mike got into comedy. Like, you know, some
you of do those think early- about me an abnormal amount.
I do.
You really are interested in my life, which is very foreign for me as a friend. Most of my friends are very much more self-involved. They're more busy. Like, they on that same ride, they would go, I wonder how I got into comedy. What was I doing? You know, like, what led me down this path? You know? I guess for me, it started with Robin Williams, watching Mork and Mindy.
Loved it.
Like, the TV that I was growing up on in the 70s, like, I was born in 75. So I was about 4 or 5 when it started making a little bit of sense to me, you know? And the show that I really gravitated towards was Mork and Mindy, where, you know, he's an alien living with a human in Colorado. And I was in Colorado when that show was on the air. And I thought he was so amazing and so funny and so brilliant at what he was doing. Because I remember they first had him on Happy Days. Like, his character of Mork appeared on Happy Days and beat the Fonz. And I thought that was incredible. Like, that was the greatest thing anyone could achieve in life at that time to me. And my brother was watching it with me. And my brother was a lot like you. He was surprisingly, uncharacteristically interested in me. And he was like, Mike, what do you want to do when you grow up? And I pointed at the TV. I was like, I want to do that. And he thought he had to explain to me that, you know, he's not actually an alien.
Yeah.
And that's not really a job. And so while he was explaining that, I was like, no, I know. He's pretending, though, right? And he was like, yeah. And I was like, well, that's what I want to do. I want to pretend for a living. And he was like, well, that you might be able to do. Like, he didn't want to over encourage me, but he was like, I think you might actually be able to do that, you know. And so he was like really supportive after that. Both of my brothers were. They were both from my mom's first marriage. So technically they're my half brothers, but they're my brothers. And one's about 10 years older than me, and one's about like 11 and a half years older than me.
Oh, cool.
And so what they would do is, at that time, they would bring home comedy albums. That was a big thing in the 70s and 80s, was like Richard Pryor had a ton of them. George Carlin had a ton of them. Bill Cosby. Billy Crystal had a tremendous comedy album. But they would just bring home anyone that they could get their hands on. Cheech and Chong, everybody.
Eddie Murphy. And, did you ever listen to Eddie Murphy?
Eddie Murphy. Yeah. Tons of Eddie Murphy. Like, I remember him doing a whole rap before rap was even a real big thing.
Boogie about, in your butt. Was
about
that one?
Sticking things in your butt. Yeah.
In your butt.
Yeah.
In your butt.
Stick a nickel. Yeah. Sure do tickle. That whole thing. Yeah. It was in your great.
Butt. Boogie in your butt.
It was so ridiculous and I loved it. And I was like, you know, 5 to 8 years old, just getting all of this. And they would like kind of sneak it in, but my parents kind of knew and they were like, hey, he likes it. He doesn't like a whole lot of stuff, but he likes this. So just let him listen to it, you know. And they would like wake me up to watch Saturday Night Live with them and stuff like that. So once they knew that it was something that I was interested in, they were super, super supportive of it and were like really big on like exposing me to as much comedy as was out there that they could get their hands on. You know, aside from like most kids, like their parents would let them watch like Saturday cartoons and stuff like that, and if they told them they wanted to be a comedian, they might show them like a couple of sitcoms or something like that. My brothers were much, much cooler about that. And my parents, our whole family cusses a lot, like a lot.
Oh, even back then?
Like, oh yeah, like a ridiculous amount. My dad was in the Navy and my mom is just a fiery Latina woman. And between the two of them, not only did they cuss, one of them cussed in Spanish. And so there was that going on. Plus my brothers were teenagers when I was a little kid, you know. And so they were all cussing. And one day something happened that I didn't like. And I was like, ah, fuck this. And everyone, like, you could hear, like, if there had been a record, it would have scratched to a halt, you know? That,
yeah.
And everyone looked at me, and they all, like, looked at each other, like, is anyone going to do anything? Is this, are we cool with this? And then they all just kind of left it alone. And I knew that at that moment, I was like, either they're going to let me cuss from now on, or I'm going to be, or they're all just hypocrites and they're going to punish me exclusively, yeah. You know?
Right, right.
And so they let me cuss and I cussed pretty much till I got to grade school. And then I just didn't really care about it that much anymore. And it was kind of funny because like a lot of my friends were at that place where when you get to grade school, that's when most kids start cussing. Is they're like, oh, my parents aren't around and I'm on the schoolyard, you know.
Yeah,
and they
yeah.
start, then they're getting like really into it. And like, I'd hear them cussing and they're like misusing words. They're like, you're full of bitch. And, you know, go damn it yourself. And so, you know, yeah, things that don't make any sense. And I was just like watching and just going, this is adorable. These guys have no idea what they're doing. and but they're having a great time. And I remember being like, oh, I wish I could feel this excited about cussing anymore. And I just didn't, you know.
Did you,
but yeah.
When you first got into stand-up, do you remember your first time doing well? Like your first time, because there's the first time and then there's the first time where we're like, wow, that actually, I could do this. This is something I could actually do.
It went, and I'm not trying to brag or anything, but it went pretty great the first time.
That's cool.
But it was kind of, they stacked the deck for me though. I'll be honest about that. What happened was I was told I was gonna get 10 minutes and me and my buddy had been kind of like hovering around, my buddy Brian, who I owe a great debt to because he kind of volunteered me to do stand-up. I didn't feel like I was ready yet. And who knows, if he hadn't done that, I might still be like, oh, maybe one of these days I'll try stand up, you know? And, but he was like, no, he'll let him do a show in 2 months. And they were like, okay, great. 10 minutes in 2 months. So I had 2 months to write my first thing, you know?
And what town was that in? Was that in Colorado somewhere?
No, that was out here in LA.
Oh.
I had done improv and theater before that, but I'd never done stand up. you know. And so I didn't want to do it in like a little pond, because I was worried that I would stay there if I got, if I like got really good at it, that I would just stay in a small town and just be like the local opener in a small town or something, you know. So I get my 10 minutes together over 2 months, and then we, right before the show starts, it's like a bringer show, you know, one of those early bringer, you know, and the guy goes, we're running real behind, instead of 10 minutes, can you do 4? And I was like, okay. And so I like condense as much as I can into 4 minutes. And so I got up on stage with like a legal pad, because I was like, there's no way I'm going to remember all this editing that I'm doing and stuff. And so I just motored through it, like 10 minutes worth of stand-up in 4 minutes. And people were like, this dude's on fire. Like, he's just going for broke. Because, like, I wasn't holding for laughs or any of the shit.
You were doing that Robin Williams style, like, right?
Yeah,
like,
I was going, like, super, super fast and just going crazy. And, and like, making up jokes on the fly about how awkward the situation was. And so it really went better that first time than it did for the, for like the next 5 or 6 times, you know, because there wasn't that adrenaline or anything like that. My third time doing stand-up was in front of Mitzi Shore at the Comedy Store.
Wow.
It was like I accidentally showcased for her early. And a guy came up afterwards and was like, you just performed in front of Mitzi Shore. And I was like, I don't know what that means. And he was like, oh my God. And so he like he explained it. And I was like, oh fuck, what have I done? You know, I've ruined my career already, you know, before I even started. Luckily she didn't remember it. It was just cause I only did like 2 minutes or something like that, you know?
Yeah. Yeah.
But Ari and Bobby, Ari Shaffir and Bobby Lee saw me, and they thought I was funny. And so they both kind of like egged on an older comic, Bob Oshak, who's a really, really funny guy.
Oh, yeah.
And the three of them and Duncan Trussell kind of like pushed to get me a showcase. And so then Ari did the job of running interference for where he was the one who sat next to Mitzi and made sure that she watched my showcase, you know, and that nobody came and bothered her, you know, like Bushman or Crispy Chicken or any of those guys.
Yeah,
you know?
Yeah.
And so that day my car broke down. I had to take the bus to the Comedy Store. The bus dropped me off right in front of the Comedy Store, which was depressing as hell. And again, they told me, they were like, you're going to do a 10-minute showcase. And I got there and Dave Taylor, my buddy, was running it. And he goes, I'm sorry to have to do this to you. It's 3 minutes. And so the same thing happened where I just motored and just mushed 10 minutes into 3. And it worked. And so Mitzi called me over and she was like, how did you come to us? And I was like, on the bus today, I took the bus. And she goes, no, idiot, where are you from? And I was like, Colorado. And she goes, I guess you can work out here. And that was, so that was my first, that was back when they did non-paid regulars and paid regulars. And she was like, you can work out here, but I'm not paying for this. And I was like, okay, thank you.
You know?
And then that's the next time went much, much better. And by then I was like going on the road with Dice and Panette and those guys. And
that's great. So, see, I did it, I'd already been doing comedy for 6 years. Like I had already done the small town thing for a year, the Bay Area. I toured doing colleges with a college tour.
You were already a name, like pretty much.
Kind of, on a certain level. And so when I showcased for her, it was like, I don't remember the time increments, but I want to say it was like 3 minutes. And then, you know, Mitzi wants to see you again. Next time you get to do, I want to say 6 minutes. And then,
yeah.
And then was it, did it go 3, 6, 9 and then 10 or something like that? I remember it was a little bit.
And they would change it. Like sometimes it was that and other times it was like, there's a 5 minute one and a 10 minute one and that's it. And then other times it's like, no, there's 37 stages now, you know, that you have to go through.
But I remember I got up to the, I got all the way up to the 10 minute one and they were like, she likes you, but she says you're not quite ready, but she will see you again. And I was like, I remember thinking like, it was like shoots and they said it was like shoots and ladders. Like I was like, ding, ding, ding.
Totally.
But it happened. I mean, compared to some people, it happened pretty fast. Like it wasn't, it all happened within a year for me with the Comedy Store. And it wasn't like,
same here.
Yeah. You know what I mean? Like I was kind of working on this club and this other thing. And so it wasn't like that was my only, and so it didn't seem like, it didn't seem like a long time. So by the time it happened, I remember thinking like, this is so naive, but I was thinking like, well, this is supposed to happen. Of course I'm, you know, a paid regular now. Like this is everything I've done. It's like, you know,
meanwhile, like there are guys there who are on their 70th showcase and they're seething with jealousy, you know?
And I know.
It's like, you're damned if you do, damned if you don't. If you get in early, everyone hates you. Yeah. If you take too long, they think you're a joke. And with her, it's like, if you showcase right away, it's like, oh, you don't respect me. You're just coming in off the street and doing a showcase.
Right.
And if you wait too long, she's like, oh, you think you're better than the Comedy Store? You're going and working everywhere else. You know, there's no right way to do it.
Yeah. They didn't want you to, from what I understood, they were like, she doesn't want to think that you've already been super polished somewhere else. She kind of wants to groom you. But then, like you said, so I remember one of my early gigs, or I was thinking about this too. One of my early first gigs, I was going to Fresno City College, and this guy I was in class with, he managed I want to say it was like a Burger King, and he goes, hey, I have an employee meeting at 10 a.m. on Saturday. He goes, do you want to do comedy at the employee meeting? And I was like, sure.
Yes.
Like, yeah, let's do it.
I absolutely want that.
It was actually, it's so funny. Like like now it'd be like, nah, but like at the time it was fun. Cause I hadn't done it yet, you know, like except for, you know, speech class and stuff like that. So I remember he goes, I'll pick you up. He goes, I have to go to the farmer's market or whatever to pick up some like heads of lettuce and all that stuff for the store. And he goes, we'll drive out to the Burger King. And he goes, you'll hide. And he had me hide in the walk-in freezer.
Hide.
Yeah. I hid in the walk-in, not the freezer part, but like the refrigerator part. And he goes, I'm going to talk to the employees. And then I'm going to go, we have a special guest. So it was like a ta-da kind of thing. Like he goes, are you ready? He goes, okay guys, are you ready for the special guest? And then he opens up the door and he goes, whatever. Please, I don't remember the exact, please welcome Darren Carter.
It'd be great if that was his intro, whatever.
But I remember I just went out like gangbusters. Same thing. I didn't hold for laughs. I didn't, was like, I had my little memorized
catch
thing.
Catch whatever you can catch because I'm spitting fire here.
Hey, everybody. And I was doing my best probably Robin Williams imitation. Hey, everybody. Ho, ho, it's great to be here. How are you? I'm Darren Carter, the party starter. Ho, ho. You know, back then, Mike, it was so funny. Like, none of this stuff would fly. It would look so corny.
Yeah, like Schwarzenegger impressions. Whatever. All the hackiest stuff. Everyone, like, their first few times when you don't know what's evil, what's on the dark side, wow, this is super easy. I can get laughs on all this easy stuff. And it's like, that's the problem. Stop doing that.
And then you're like, then you start looking around going, hey, that guy also does a Kermit the Frog impression, and so does that guy, and we're all doing
it.
We're all a bunch of hacks.
No. There sure are a lot of Christopher Walkens here.
Exactly. Back then it was, so this is back when Ted Turner was colorizing a lot of black and white movies. And it was like a controversy. So, and I used to have bright red hair. So my thing was, and I was trying to look for an old photo. Look, this isn't even, this is sometime after that, but this is probably me when I'm like 30.
Yeah.
But when I'm doing comedy,
look at all the hope in those eyes.
Yeah, exactly. That was after I was in LA for a while. So you got to imagine this guy minus 8 years.
You can look at that face and see exactly how many hand jobs he's taken.
Yeah. Look at that.
Three and a half.
Yeah. This guy was in a freezer, a walk-in freezer.
Yeah. Doing comedy in a walk-in freezer.
So I popped out doing my Eddie Murphy impression. And my big thing back then was that I was pretending that I was Eddie Murphy, and that I'd been sitting in a makeup chair for 6 hours, and that Ted Turner had colorized me. And I was like,
wow.
I was colorized.
That is edgy shit, Darren.
Exactly.
I'd be very careful.
I was colorized by Ted Turner.
Oh, my God.
I don't even remember the jokes, but yeah.
That would so not play today.
Oh, yeah, dude. I know. It was like,
wow.
I know. It was like, I remember even at the time I had a friend that was a black guy that was a cab driver. His name was Daryl. I forget his last name. He was a cab driver in San Francisco. And I remember running that joke past him, and he was like, it's funny, man, do it. But you got to remember, this is like 25 years ago. So,
right.
Yeah. Now it's kind of
like, it was a different time. It was, you can't be held accountable
exactly
for what you did 25 years ago. Yeah. Well, you can if it's murder, but that was not murder. That was just a weird bit.
Do you have certain bits and jokes from back then that you're like, that probably wouldn't hold up in today's, I probably shouldn't.
Yeah, I did live at Gotham and on Comedy Central. And at that time, I was always very conscious of the fact that material can get dated very easily.
Smart.
And that I tried to do stuff that was kind of evergreen in general, and tried to stay away from politics because of that and that sort of thing.
Yeah.
And they had a deal that you had to do where you did 7 minutes of evergreen material, but you also had to do 3 minutes of topical material.
Oh,
and I didn't have anything like that.
Yeah.
And the only joke that was working in the clubs that I tried out that was topical, the joke was, the Queen of England has turned 80 today, which was true. She had turned 80 at the time. And I go, I should clarify, the Queen of England that doesn't sing Candle in the Wind has turned 80 today. And that was the only joke that was getting a big laugh, but it is a joke that I would not do today. You know, not even, it's a pretty tame joke, but still it's like, no, I don't want to offend anyone. So
that, you don't want to be, you don't want the thing where it's like, you want people, I want people laughing. I'm not trying to.
Like, I really feel like there are now people that are kind of professional victims. They go out to be offended by stuff, and I don't like it, but it's happening. And there are things where the good side of that is that a lot of people that really didn't think that stuff was all that funny in the first place, someone is speaking for them. And so it makes me look at the jokes that I do and go, if it's doing that to someone, well, I don't want it to do that. All I want my jokes to do is make people laugh. And I want people to forget about all their bullshit when they see me. I don't want it to drudge anything up and make people be like, oh, that sucks. You know,
right.
There's this guy was making me laugh, and now I think he hates me. You know, you know, like,
I got rid of all that stuff. At least I think I did. I got rid of the stuff where I'm like,
and you never know. It's like, in
there's
a part of me that will be kind of like, it's a guilty pleasure that I'm going to have when I'm like 70 years old and I see the children of millennials correcting them.
Yeah.
Like, Dad, you don't call those cyborgs. Yeah. They are enhanced humans, Dad. You can't call them robots. They don't, it's not cool. You know, when that starts happening to them, I'm going to be really happy, just because it's like, a lot of the correcting that's going on right now, it's like, you're, most of it is coming from younger people that haven't really done a whole hell of a lot.
Yeah.
Or,
I remember like years ago, I did a college, and I was with another comedian, and he was trying to tell me, I go, which way is the whatever? We'll just say the bathroom. And he's, oh, you want to go over there? And he goes, see where that chick is in the green? And the lady at the school was like, we don't call women chicks. And I was like, oh, I'm sorry. I didn't think of that. He didn't even know that he said that. And it was just like,
it'd be so great if there was a giant like chicken mascot standing over there wearing something green. And he's like, I didn't.
I
still catch myself saying stuff like that. And if I'm talking to someone from my generation, I am a lot less worried, you know, that they're going to freak out about it, but you never know. And it's like, if that happens to me, if someone calls me on it, I'm trying really hard not to take it personally.
Yeah.
And just understand that they're really trying to help me adapt to the way the world is changing, you know, be like, okay, that wasn't my intent. What should I say? Usually how I'll respond.
Yeah.
Or I'll shake my fist and go, leave me alone, you dumb kid. And then I'll run away.
Yeah. Do you remember your first big TV or movie that you booked? The first thing that was like wow, I'm actually.
Yeah. What I wouldn't give to be able to have movies to tell you about.
Have you booked any movies or did you book any movies?
Not that I know of. I mean, like, I've done like student films and stuff, like things that might have somehow.
You might be in the background of a documentary
on Amazon or something. Yeah. But like, I think there are times where I feel like I was being filmed when I don't think I was. That date with the magic card girl that, you know, that.
Yeah, it's a hidden camera movie.
Yeah. But no, I did some fun TV show stuff. Live at Gotham was probably the best thing for me as far as, you know, because it was like me doing stand-up, Joe Rogan was hosting, and this, it was a good crop of comics to be awesome. Amongst and I got to go to New York, and we were right near Times Square, the hotel was right there, and I was in New York walking across the street in Times Square. And who should be walking across back towards me but Bob Oshak from the Comedy Store. Cool. And we just ran into each other, and we both just described the crappy travel arrangements we'd been given. And he won because they booked him on an airline offshoot that I'd never heard of called Delta Song. He's like, they flew me in on Delta Song. And I was like, what is that exactly? And he goes, I think it's like the last leg of trips from Japan to New York. Is they stop, Delta Song stops in LA, and then he takes them the rest of the way to New York.
Oh my god.
He was like, because it was just me and a bunch of Asian businessmen, and that was it.
Wow. I remember one of the last time I was in New York, I got hired to be on the Ricky Lake show.
And oh wow.
It was cool, wasn't man.
They canceled.
It was canceled.
Yeah, in the mid '90s.
No.
Was the new Ricky Lake show.
Yeah. I don't know. I know it was in the 2000s. I know that.
Oh, okay.
I remember.
Was she? May I ask if she was thin Ricky Lake?
Thin Ricky Lake, and it was. I think the show got canceled. Maybe I want to say like a year later or something. No, it was.
Couldn't possibly have been your fault.
It was like an American Idol type of, because American Idol was popular, and they wanted, they hired me, Monique, and one other person, and we were like the celebrity judges, and it was for like a talent show, and it was called Parent Idol.
So a precursor to Last Comic Standing, sort of.
Yeah, but it was like a silly little, like, she's like, hey, we're gonna have it's gonna be like American Idol, except it's the parents are gonna sing, and then, you know, and then we would like hold up cards, like, you know, you made it, you didn't make it, whatever. But it, as far as the business side, it was cool because they flew me out there, they put me in a hotel, and they paid me like $1,000.
Wow.
And And I was like, man, this could
that
be
that feels a like a big deal, doesn't it?
It felt like a big deal because I didn't have to pay for my flight. You know, and because it's so rare that I was going there, I'm like, I'll just take cabs. I don't want to get on the subway. I'll just pay for cabs.
I have $1,000.
Exactly. I got $1,000. I got there a day early and didn't.
You were the last person I would put in New York with $1,000 cash.
Yeah, exactly.
Especially riding around in cabs and shit.
You know, I know.
That just seems like a bad idea.
I felt like it was like a rich, like I was like, I'm rich now. Like this is like, if I can get like, if I can be a regular on the Ricky Lake show as like a funny judge, you know, like,
oh yeah,
like do it once a week. I mean, that'd be like,
did you pitch that to her?
I think my agent did. My agent goes, hey, he's ready to do more. Just let us know. And then
they got a really funny judge.
Exactly. Yeah.
What if that was the difference between that show getting canceled and not, if she had just said yes and it was still on the air to this day?
I know.
Dude, you could have saved Ricky Lake.
That would be, I would love it.
I hope you're watching, Ellen, because funny judge is here.
I'm the funny judge.
And he's available.
It was so, I was like, this is an easy gig, Mike. It was easy. They, like I said, they pay you, they fly you out there and I think this is
he'll
one of those
be ruling
shows.
And the audience will be rolling.
Yeah. You don't even have to think of anything because they have like a little thing in the ear. So they feed you like little things if you want them, and you're just cracking up, and dude, it was like it was like an easy job. But you know, I've been on, if it's funny, he'll allow it. Yeah. I've been on some sitcoms before, like, you know, and a couple lines here and there, maybe one or two scenes. And I got to be honest, it's not as satisfying, I didn't think, as stand-up. Because when you just, like you said, when you did Gotham and it's all you for like 7 minutes or 8 minutes or whatever it is, that's way better than, here's your pizza. Okay.
And then like, yeah. Yeah. It's you know, much better than that.
I know.
But, you know, I would like to, I agree. But in a way, it's like what I think you and I have been offered is the open mic slash bringer experience of sitcoms.
Oh.
Now, if it were like an actual role, you know, where like you talk a lot and have a character to develop and that sort of thing, and you know you're doing a whole season, you know, of a show.
Yeah. Like let's say you're a regular at the bar. Like everybody knows Mike Blackson at the bar.
Yeah.
He's got those three funny lines and the question.
Right.
He's in like a couple times.
That I think would be a lot of fun to try and to like, by then you're like getting to know the writers and the directors and stuff. And like, hey, I have an idea for a line or whatever, you know, that sounds like a lot more fun.
Yeah. Cause right now it's like, I'm at the level where it's like, I'm there for the 3 days and hey, I have an idea. And then they fire you.
Yeah, you have an idea and you're like, well, that idea fucks up the whole shoot and it's going to add 2 days to the schedule that we don't have, you know.
One time I did this show, it was it actually was on Fox. It was on Sunday nights. It starred Michael Strahan and I forget who else. It was called Brothers, I believe. And
I remember that show existing.
But they rearranged it so much. Like at one point I was going to be a regular at the bar and then they fired the bartender, so then they made me the bartender the next day, and then they just kept moving my
changing it around.
Yeah And then the next thing you know, I was off the show, so I didn't even make the air. But it was like, I got really, I know, it was crazy. I got paid still, and the guy saw me, one of the head writers saw me do comedy, and he goes that thing you did on stage. And then they basically were gonna have me do that as the character, like in the sitcom, man. Yeah. Then
I have a story that fits into all of this that it didn't occur to me till what you were talking about. But when I first got out here, I'd done a couple Nike commercials back to back and they just kind of kept using me. And then I got like a Jack in the Box right on the heels of that. And I went in to drop off new headshots at my commercial agent. And there was some guy there visiting them. And he sees me on the couch and he goes, this guy would be right for that. You should submit him. And they, my commercial people at the time, I'm not going to say their names because this sounds bad, but they go, Mike, would you have any interest in being on a sitcom? And I was like, what do you think I've been doing here?
Yeah.
For the last 2 years? Like, yeah. Yes. Yeah. Please put me on a sick. And so they send me out. And on the first audition that I ever did for a sitcom, I went to network, which is kind of unheard of. It's like really, really rare that that happens. And the show that I did never happened, but I am pretty sure it was like a sort of a rough draft or a template for Arrested Development. Because it was about a guy whose three screw-up kids move back into the house with him, and he has to kind of deal with them. And a lot of the people that were ended up being on Arrested Development were at the network audition. And the very first audition that I had there in the morning, it was me and the guy who was the hologram doctor on Star Trek Voyager.
Oh, cool.
And he was really nice and really supportive. Then they go, you did really well. Can you come back this afternoon? And I was like, sure, come back here. And they were like, no, you're going to go to the Sony lot and audition there. Memorize your script as fast as you can. And because it's going to be the same stuff, but you'll be going before network. And I'm like, okay. Then I find out, like, in the meantime, that the guy who created the show was Gilda Radner's writing partner on Saturday Night Live and all this stuff. And it was like this, it was a big deal that this guy liked me and wanted to, like, put me on this thing. And so I get there, and what I didn't realize is that a network one, everyone that they're seriously considering kind of hangs out in the executive offices of the building together. And it's this weird, we're going to go in a certain order, but we're all hanging out together until then. And so there were like two or three actors that I didn't recognize that were up for the same part that I was. But I get there early, and I was like, I pulled out a sketch pad and I started sketching in it. And Harlan Williams comes over and he goes, you drawing there, buddy? You doing a little, some drawings? And I was like, yeah. And he goes, I draw too. I'm going to draw. Maybe I'll draw you. Who knows? You know, and he starts like drawing his pad, and his stuff's really good. And we're both kind of like, oh, that's neat. And we hear a guy go, oh, do you guys like art? And we go, yeah. And we look over, and it's Martin Mull. He goes, this is my summer catalog of the art that I've done in my gallery. And he shows us like real paintings, like real legit artwork that he's done. And so we both just like immediately fold up our sketch pads and put them away. And then there were these veggie pops and Cheetos on the table. And I distinctly remember hearing this guy before I saw him, and he goes, you know, if you leave those out too long, they turn into those. And it was Alan Miller, the comedian. And I was like, oh my God, I can't believe all these people are here. And so then the guy who had created the show, Alan Zweibel, his partner, came up to me, and she goes, I loved your tape. I thought you were so great. I'd like you to meet someone while you're here. Just so if nothing else happens, you can say you met this guy. And I was like, okay. And I'm like with that kind of intro, I'm like, is it Santa? Am I meeting Santa Claus? And she kind of gets in front of the guy, and she goes, Mike Black, Henry Winkler. And I was like, what? And he like, it couldn't have been framed better. He had like a magazine up, and he brings it down and he goes, Mike Black, that's a tremendous stage name. And I was like, thank you. Like, I don't know what to do. I'm literally meeting a guy. Like, I have a poster of this guy in my room back home, you know? Yeah. And I was like, this is insane. And so in the meantime, they have us sign the contract. Just in case you get the job, they make you sign the contract so you don't try and renegotiate on them.
Yeah.
And they were like, call your agent and see if this seems fair to to you guys and then sign it if it does. Well, it basically said, if you get this job, you'll get $200,000 just for doing it.
Wow.
You know, just for doing that first season. You know, if you add it all up, you'll get about 200 grand. No pressure, right?
So, yeah.
You know, so we go through all that. Henry Winkler is going, everyone is starving. We've all been here way too long. Is there food in this place? And they were like, we can send out for sandwiches. And he was like, I'll find food. And he just starts rummaging around in the different cubicles and offices. And nobody's going to stop him from doing that. And so he finds all these power bars and stuff and starts just passing them out to all the actors. Mm-hmm. And I was like, this is the greatest thing I've ever seen in my life. The Fonz just passing out free food to everybody that he is legit stealing.
I heard him in an interview. I guess he was a producer on MacGyver, and he said that he was big on catering. He goes, you know, you got to have great catering at these places. Like, you want people to be
happy, believes in it,
well fed, and he
definitely does.
You know,
and like, he could not have been more gracious or supportive or what have you. You know, and so then they go, okay, here's the order that we're going to go in today for the network executives to watch each of your auditions. And the upshot of it, the basic order was, we are going to go in order of fame from least famous to absolute most famous, and then Mike. So I was like, you got to be fucking kidding me. I didn't say anything. What can you say?
Yeah.
But they were like, yeah, it'll be, you know, Mr. Miller, Mr. Mull, Mr. Williams, and then Henry Winkler, and then Mike. And I was like, oh, fucking great. This is going to be
a
nightmare. You know, like, there's no way I'm following this. And as I would swear they were throwing rose petals at his feet as Henry Winkler was leaving the room. You know, they were all just delighted. They were like, oh, what a wonderful man. What a great time we all just had. And like, some of them were like putting their coats on, like, what a great evening we had, you know, they're ready to go home or whatever.
Well, folks, show's over. Okay.
It's all done. And they were like, no, there's one more. And they're like, we'd really rather end here, you know? And so they've all got like their arms folded and they're like, I guess, you know? And so I start to walk in as Henry Winkler's walking out, and he gives me a little wink, like, go get him, kid, that sort of thing. And I go, thanks. And I do this.
The thumbs up.
The thumbs up. And he kind of like looks at me for a second, like, are you really doing? Okay. And then he just keeps going. And then I still have my thumbs out. And I realize what I just did and who I just did it to. And there's like a little lady who's like the security guard there holding the door open for me. And she goes, I don't think he noticed. And I was like, God, I hope not. I was like, God, I'm an asshole. And so I went in and, you know, I did my audition and it went okay, but the show never got picked up. So, you know.
Hey, but you got a great story out of it. And what a cool experience, man.
It was a lot of fun.
That's
my first time being on the Fox lot at the time. It's the Sony one now, I guess.
You know, we got to wrap up, but I got to tell you, what made me think of this too is I was reading, this guy recently had written this post about how he auditioned for a play and he got it but he'd never acted before. He'd never really been anything big. And he said it the way he wrote it was so, I was getting anxiety reading this because he said basically it was like memorizing like 45 pages of dialogue.
Oh my God.
And he said it was just so difficult. And he said it was a play, live play, live. So you have to, like, you can't, I mean, you know, it's a play.
Yeah.
And he said that he was honestly, he goes, I was about 33% there and it was still a week out. And even the other two actors were really nice. They would really try to help me. And he goes, and it got to the point and he goes, they basically fired him because
wow.
It was going to be a failure. And I was just like, I know I've struggled with memorizing sides and scripts. Like I've never had to memorize a bunch of dialogue. Have you ever had to do that?
I have. I did a lot of plays and theater and stuff when I was younger, but I know a very easy trick that's very quick that I can tell you for doing that. Let's say you have to memorize like the Hamlet monologue, just as an example, that starts with, you know, to be or not to be, that is the question. What you do is you don't do any acting. You just do it word by word all the way through the script with all of your lines. So you would go, as you're looking at it, you would go to be or not to be. And you just keep doing that all the way through the script. And by the end of it, the amount of repetition that you've done, you'll just have it in your head. And you'll have it not with specific acting choices that you made. So it'll just be like text in your head. And then you can adjust it and act and change as much as you want, because you haven't married to a specific way of saying it. You know what I mean? It's just like a very rote way of doing it. Where you run into trouble is those last few lines, you know, where you've only said them like once or twice. It's good to, the last time that you run it, where you're running that last line, tape that time and then just play that while you're sleeping, you know, and let it play in the background while you're sleeping.
You know, a trick I used to do is, I would have whoever I'm doing the scene with, I would read both parts into my phone recorder. Mm-hmm. And so I can act with the other, because what would happen is I would forget my cues. Yeah. Like I'd remember my lines, but I didn't know when to say them.
Right.
Yeah,
I've had plays where I'm literally half the script and the other guy is the other half the script.
Did you ever get nervous where you, this would happen to me too. Like I could practice in the mirror. I could practice by myself. I could practice with a friend. But then when I got in the casting room, now I'm looking at a new person's face and their assistant and a camera person. And I'm like, and it would throw me off. Cause I'm like strangers. Like, I don't know. I got over that, but that was definitely a thing it would stump me in the earlier days.
It stumped me, but then I realized that's part of the game. And what I mean by that is they're doing that on purpose. Mm. They want it to be uncomfortable. They want it to be less than ideal, because in a 16-hour day, there are going to be a lot of times where takes are going to be less than ideal and where something will get screwed up or what have you. And they just want to see if you can handle it and if you can just keep going. You know,
I feel like you would be really good at auditioning. I took this acting class. He was great. Brian Reese over on, not Fairfax, but what's that street between Sunset and Santa Monica? Fountain.
Fountain, yes.
Yeah. And so we would do, about once every 6 weeks, we'd run this thing where you'd practice auditioning. And basically, like, people would act like it's a casting office, and you'd enter the room, and they'd be like, Mike Black. Hi, Mike. How are you? They'll be like, Darren's ready to see you, the casting. And so you get to see what it was like when people would audition. It was almost like a run through. And you'd see like how, like, you know, they go, you want to be memorable for the day. If they're looking at like 80 actors, you don't want to be the guy that's like, so what's going on? And they're like, nothing. And you're just like, you're just like, let me get to the script. Can we just get this audition over with? You want to be, you know.
I'm ready to work. Please.
I need to.
There was a guy who he was on 24 and he was always like the president's security guard, red-haired actor, character actor. I assume you all know each other.
David Caruso.
Different red-headed actor. But he would do a thing that I thought was interesting where maybe he would put like a penny in his shoe or a piece of gravel or he would get a hangnail or something like that, or put like maybe a marble in the corner of his mouth or something. But he would have something distracting him from all the other crap that should be distracting him. And it would help him get through auditions. And he would be like, no matter what they threw at me, I'm busy thinking about that thing in my shoe or whatever. And that I have to just do my act and not worry about that thing in my shoe. And none of the other stuff seemed to matter nearly as much as that thing in his shoe did. So
he was
able to get through it that way. I get different people develop different tricks.
For I remember they would teach us like basically how to do the small talk part, like just to be memorable, you know, like be positive, you know, like, so how's it going? Like instead of saying like nothing or you're like, things are great. I just got off a set. I was booked in Bangkok. We did a short film, you know, whatever.
Yeah.
You know, or like
booked in Bangkok. That's going to be the name of your autobiography.
I was
Darren Carter. I was booked in Bangkok.
Like a lot of stuff that seemed like it that stood out was either people coming off of other jobs, so kind of lets the people know you're working, or there were a lot of people did like volunteer work. Like if you have nothing going on and you haven't booked shit in 10 years, you could always like, well, I just got done volunteering at the hospital and the life is great and I'm ready.
Those two tricks work, and the other one that works is anything about your kids. Well, I was able to feed my kid this week, so that's something. You know, that gets all the casting directors going, boy, this guy needs a job.
Exactly. Oh, yeah. There's
something.
Some big audition do's and don'ts. Like the big don't they said is don't complain about how there's no parking. Don't complain about traffic.
Right.
They said, a couple Southern people were in there and they were being very polite. And they said, don't refer to people. And they go, especially in this town, is sir and ma'am, because it might sound like you're aging them up or something.
Yeah.
Because they want to be like the, hey, I'm the, you know, I'm
the young, hip, cool.
Yeah. And you're like, yes, sir. No, sir. Thank you, sir. Yes, ma'am. And they're doing it out of politeness, but it's coming across like,
Well, I've known plenty of Southern people. My dad is Southern, you know, and even so, when I would go and do comedy around at places and a young guy would go, thank you for performing tonight, sir. I'd still be like, what is he talking about? What, like? Why is he talking to me like that? You know?
I know.
In LA, it's a sign of aggression. You know?
I know. I remember I was at the local restaurant here in Burbank one time. And it's kind of a fancier restaurant. Like Slash was there one time. I think it's called
That is fancy.
Yeah. McCormick and Schmick's or something. I don't know. Like, I referred to this guy as the waiter as I called him sir, and he's like, he got mad at me, but like he kind of put me in my place or whatever. And
wow.
You know, yeah, it was weird. He was like,
I don't know. It's like, again, it comes back to intent. It's like, I wasn't trying to offend you. What do you want me to call?
It's like, come on, man. I'm just trying
Admiral.
Yes, exactly.
Call me Admiral of the Waiters.
Yes. One time a guy got mad at me for calling him a bellhop, but that's what I thought they were called. I didn't know.
Yeah.
You know, there was a movie called Bellhop.
Yeah.
By the way, that.
There was a movie called Bellhop, asshole.
You asshole. Yeah. Hey, so are you, before we go, where are you parked? It looks like there's a UFO landing behind you. It's just, another car.
Some sketchy guy who thought this chicken place was still open and it isn't, but he's slowly driving past me in like a Yugo.
Yeah. Oh, really? I used to have a Yugo. Now, is it weird? Are you that you're parked in your car in some sketchy neighborhood with a light on your face?
It's not a sketchy neighborhood. It's an okay neighborhood. I'm right next to a clothing drop, but it's still an okay neighborhood.
I mean, I don't know where you're at. It just sounds like.
No, I'm in Culver City at the moment, because that's where the chicken place was.
And you don't want to say the name of the chicken place?
Can I really Google? Don't. You know. Oh. But there are a number.
What do you mean?
There's a myriad of chicken places in Culver City. You're not going to find it.
I like how you don't want us to know what it is.
No. I don't want to advertise for a place.
Okay, I got you. You know,
like
yeah.
I don't want to endorse a place because then someone will eat there and go, "Mike Black told me to eat here, and now I got food poisoning, and I'm going to die." And I don't.
Yeah.
I don't need.
Yeah. That's true. You don't need it. Hold on, I'm looking up chicken in.
What are you doing?
Culver
trying to rat me out.
City.
Are you?
Oh, I know where you're at.
Are you doing Google Earth?
You're at Honey's Kettle Fried Chicken. You're at El Pollo Loco. You're at Jollibee's.
I'm not telling you where I'm at.
Okay. All right. Come on down. There's 30 chicken restaurants in Culver City.
Dirty bastard.
He's in one of these 30. They're all closed, according to Google, so I don't know where you're
yeah,
at.
Yeah, but I don't know what people are going to – can you imagine if anyone was that motivated they got out of there? Hot shit, Mike's over in a chicken place.
Yeah.
We got to get over there. It's this closed, but it'll –
It's funny.
Maybe he'll tell us the story.
Because you kind of don't want to say the name of it. And then as people are going by, all I'm seeing is this. Like, you're just looking around. Like,
yeah.
No, I did a Zoom interview with somebody, and I pulled off the freeway.
See, you don't want to say either. Yeah. You're like, I know. I was doing the Zoom interview with somebody.
Somebody in a freeway, and I was at a gas station, but it was yeah. near Fresno, and dude, it looked like the guy next to me looked like a meth head or something. He was super skinny, and he's getting ready to go into this gas station, and he pulls up his mask, which we all have to do, but it looked like he was about to rob the place. But I'm right. Like, oh yeah, well, that's normal. Okay, like the bandana, yeah. and
perfectly I was like, perfectly normal. Yeah.
But halfway during the interview, I stopped looking at the host, and I was just like looking at that guy. He's like, "What are you looking at?" I go, "Dude, look over there, man." And I move the camera and stuff. And
yeah. Me and Paul Zeiss, the character actor, used to do a podcast called Live on Sunset, where we would just find different locations on Sunset Strip and set up and do a podcast. And whatever crazies walked by would talk to us. And Paul was a bouncer, so he didn't care. But I often found us in situations where I was like, this person is gonna infect one of us with something, you know.
Yeah, yeah. You're like, let's keep our distance. So
and I'm like, you know, I'm not a germaphobe, but I found out one guy who was like trying to clean up downtown, he somehow was barefoot and stepped on something, and they had to take his foot off.
Whoa.
And so now he goes around in a wheelchair and he keeps doing the same job. And I'm like, you got a pass for life. If cleaning up the city cost you a foot, you can stop. You can just start using styrofoam every day for the rest of your life if you want to, you know.
Styrofoam, straws, the whole thing.
Yeah, all of it. No, you don't even have to cut up the thing between cans or any of that stuff.
Right.
You just do whatever the hell you want at that point.
Uh-oh, I think the logo's on that cup.
No, it's not. You'll never know where I've eaten chicken today.
Mike's mystery chicken. Anyways, Mike, thanks for being on the show, man. I want to have you back on. It's always fun to talk to you, and we haven't even dove into any of this.
I really am a lot of fun.
You know, you super are, man. You really are. Thank you. Thank you. We got to have some mystery chicken sometime.
Yeah, let's do that.
I won't tell anyone where we're at. Yeah.
No, you won't, because I'm going to blindfold you and bring you to Mystery Chicken Place.
And I'm going to be like, you lied to me. This is even Culver City.
This tastes like beef. This is not chicken at all.
I feel like I'm having beef in Sherman Oaks. Where are we?
This is not what you led me to believe.
Mike, man, you're the best. Take care, and thanks for being on the Pocket Party Podcast. And you guys,
you
follow
too, man.
Mike.
I wouldn't miss it.
Follow Mike Black Attack online, social media, Mike Black Attack.
We're done with this interview.
Everybody listen to Darren Carter. We all know he's the party starter. So if you want to listen to a podcast for free, then listen to The Pocket Party.